All right, so this is John from Worst Comic Podcast Ever, and we are doing our latest episode of Between Two Tables here for O Comic Con. And I am fortunate enough to have on my right James Drake, who is the president and CEO of Realm Walker Publishing. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You bet, absolutely. How's your con been?
You know, this has been really, really fantastic. It's a first-time con. In a small, medium-sized market, you never know what you're going to get.
Totally.
And, I knew Matt from before, and when he mentioned that he was going to do this, there was one part of me goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And then there's another part of me goes, wow, that could really go bad.
Totally.
I really didn't know what to expect. And Friday, I was pleasantly surprised.
Absolutely.
And yesterday, I was completely blown away. I couldn't believe the number of people that were here, and not just comic fans, and not just people that had anime background or a cosplay background. We had families here. We had about every nook and cranny of this city came out and came here yesterday.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the number of people that we talked to for whom this was a first time con, but were totally decked out. I mean, I think right now the idea of the Comic-Con has become so much more in the public knowledge, and shows like Big Bang Theory and stuff like that, I think, have really made people familiar with the idea of what a Comic-Con is, and that it's not just, I mean, we're a comic book podcast, but that there's all sorts of nerddom here. It's not just one area.
Right.
And it's just a place for people to come and be who they are. And they can't necessarily always do that in their other walks of life. I'm also really thrilled to see how many young people there are, people in their teens who are out and dressed up.
Right.
There for a while, at Planet Comic Con in Kansas City, especially early, most of the people that were there looked pretty much like me.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of middle-aged white guys
for
the most part.
That's too bad for them, huh?
It is unfortunate that we all have that many faces for radio is a shame. But I'm thrilled to see more women, more young people. You have to have that. I mean, if you're not pulling in those people, then your industry is doomed. But I think there's a lot of people here who are clearly have been hungry for something like this, and are really excited about it.
Well, this market, they have NebraskaCon, but that is really, I mean, it's never going to be bigger than the one hotel it's in.
Okay,
it's never. I am nothing against them, but it is a very niche feeling environment there. This had a lot more open, broad appeal. I think that the thing that Matt Fujian did very well in organizing this event was having a wide swath of guests. I mean, the first thing that caught my eye is he had professional wrestlers here, starting with Matt Foley.
Right.
And I'm like, well, there you go. That's going to draw a certain audience. And then, he had Chekhov from Star Trek here. That's going to draw a certain contingent. There were just so many different guests from such a wide range of things. It wasn't really surprising to me, but at the same time, it was.
Right. No, and it's smart because, like you said, I mean, you could have 10 awesome comic book guests, but if that's all you have, you've now all those people are all coming to see the same people. I mean, you're drawing the same audience for those 10 people. You get people from wrestling and from comics, and you've got television shows, and you've got stuff that, American Horror Story, people that, some of those younger people are really excited about. Now you're drawing in all those different guests, but they still come in and walk around the floor and look at everything else. So it's a great range. These people who don't necessarily know each other's nerd area, but they still come for that.
The one thing that I think is really interesting to note is that at a first time event like this, you really have a lot of leeway with the audience,
right?
Because you're not pigeonholed into doing what you did in the past,
right?
And so what he could do is he could be very broad in his guest selections. He could be very broad in even the exhibitors that are going to be at the event, simply because that there's there could be it could be a little bit for anybody, and nobody's expecting, well, they didn't do this last year.
Right.
And so I think that that made it really a great opportunity for him to kind of see what works.
Right.
And I think that this weekend proved that this show has a future.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. Yeah. I look at this and we're already excited and talking about, coming back next year and what we're going to do and sort of anticipating a little bit. I think we anticipated a little smaller show than we ended up getting. So something like this, word only spreads. Yeah. and people tell their friends and I think it just grows. And, well, even this year, yesterday you couldn't have as many people because graduation was actually here. So, those graduation weekends are always tough. People are parties and stuff like that. But still, I think it'll be even bigger next year. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Realm Walker Publishing.
Well, Realm Walker Publishing Group was a company that I started about a year ago. Originally, the plan was I wanted to have a company to legitimize my self-publishing efforts, my own self-publishing efforts. And it makes it so much easier in terms of, getting into bookstores and, having wide distribution and stuff like that, to have a company face to put behind it. And it's also important for tax reasons. But that's but I realized that there is a growing group of self-published authors who are outstanding writers that know nothing about marketing their book.
Right.
And truly have no understanding on what it takes to get from, for self-publishing nowadays, it's so easy. All you really need to have is a Word document, a piece of art for the cover, and a computer, and you can be on Amazon in a couple of days.
Right.
At the most.
Right.
And that lowered bar has created a problem because now everybody who has the idea that they can write, people who can write and people who can't write, for that matter, are publishing. And it puts a lot of product out there, and some of it's amazing, some of it's okay, and some of it's really, really bad.
Yeah, and it's tough sometimes to find those nuggets of gold.
Right.
Among all that other stuff.
So what I started doing is I started keeping my eyes open on the various, like on Reddit. I spend a lot of time on Reddit. Started finding and identifying authors who I thought needed a little bit of help. And I thought, well, I come from a consultancy background from web design. And I started thinking, well, maybe I could help some of these people get a good website or, give them some ideas on marketing or whatever. And I started realizing that some of these people are better writers than I am. And some of them have amazing stories that just don't know what to do. And the problem is that at what point do you separate yourself from being a consultant to being a publisher? And I realized I'm just going to go in full gang on this and start helping people bring their books to print.
Right.
Be a small press. Be local. Make sure I get, books in the hands of the people that like them, and people hear about the books that they need to read. And that's where this all came about.
We've had this conversation with a number of local artists in Kansas City who, really had to learn. They were like, I knew art, but I didn't know business and how to do taxes and how, people who went to art school, but like they never told us, they never had a class on the economics of how do I price things, how do I market this stuff. And so those are skills you either have to learn or you have to find somebody to help you with.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things that I've learned, obviously, because I've been doing this for a little while now, is there's a lot of people out there that say, cover's the most important thing for a book. Because, everyone does judge a book by its cover.
Right.
But they don't realize that if they spend $1,000 on great cover art and they're only going to sell 1,000 books, that's a dollar per book that cover costs.
Right.
And when you're trying to, keep your price as low as possible to be competitive to all the other great authors out there that are being, they're leveraging market.
Oh, right. Yeah, because they're spending $1,000 on a cover, but selling it to a million copies.
Right. It's a completely different equation there. So
right.
It's about finding, I'm also identifying great artists who have talent that need an audience that are willing to do the work for a cheaper, you know, a little bit cheaper, but are amazing at what they do. One of them is my business partner, Seth Roswell Penn. Excellent guy. Love his middle name, by the way.
Oh, wait, it's
Roswell.
That's nice.
It's really Roswell. and he comes from a comic background.
Okay.
And one of the most exciting things for me was identifying his talent, realizing I can have him illustrate the inside of my book, the exterior of my book, and doing all the work that we need to have illustrated. He can, you know, he can identify those artists who are great, those who are average, whatever, and give them, you know, it's kind of like what we did with the authors. These great artists that don't have a great marketing angle yet or market penetration or even visibility, giving them that visibility and at the same time giving them some money to be able to, you know, fund their future projects.
Yeah, and, you know, like you said, a cover can sell a book. But once you read the book is going to sell book two.
Right.
I mean, it's the inside of the book that's going to bring the person back to that author. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's you know, you don't want to be so short-sighted as to say, let's put an awesome cover on this crappy book.
Right.
Because you're going to make your money as they come back and back down the line. So.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And one of the things that shows like this are geared for, like, why we're here is not just to sell books, but to find evangelists. Find those individuals out there that are going to read the book and be blown away.
Right.
And tell other people about it, because you need those people. Those are the people that are going to get people. Those are the people that come to cons like this dressed like your characters.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then people go, I don't know who that person is. And they start asking. Still waiting for that moment, by the way. But, you know, with each day there's fresh hope. But that's what we're doing here. That's what really what fandom is all about and shows like this are all about is, you know, is reaching out to these fans that love their stuff. They love their fantasy. They love their sci-fi. They love their comics. They love their movies. They love their TV shows. And all you have to do is just capture their imagination for a few seconds and not be a complete jerk to them when you meet them person to person.
Right.
And they'll give you a shot.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you tell us about a couple of the, maybe about a couple of the titles that you have.
Great. The first one I'd like to talk about is Claire Frank. She's actually here today. She flew in from Seattle to promote her book at this show.
Oh, nice.
And her series is called The Echoes of Amara. Now, the great thing about some of this the fantasy that's out there now, or the sci-fi and fantasy that's out there now, but done by authors, self-pub authors, is that they take chances. And most fantasy, you know, one of the biggest fantasy tropes out there is the young person who discovers their power and then goes out and uses that power to save the world.
I've never seen that story before.
Right. Yeah.
Except all the stories.
Like
sometimes.
Every story.
Yeah.
And
no, I'll tell you, somebody who was reading the Percy Jackson series. I had a student of mine. I was like, oh, look, it's Harry Potter. And they're like, no, this is Percy Jackson. I go, come on.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's nothing like. I go, let's see. It's a young man who grew up in an ordinary, perhaps less than ordinary life, suddenly discovers somehow that he's not only a part of some magical hidden world that only a select number of people know about, but he is the pivotal character in that he is one of the most powerful. He has a couple of friends. One is sort of the comic sidekick, and one who's the really smart girl.
Right.
And they go around and do all this stuff. It's like, she's like, okay, yeah, when you say it like that, it sounds like Harry Potter. I go, because it's a similar story. And partially because it's a time-honored story. I mean, that is that's a story that's the one that is the classic mythology story.
Well, and most people start reading fantasy when they're 12, 13, 14 years old.
Totally.
And same thing with comics. You know, you have the same kind of thing that happens in comics. You have the same type of thing that happens in movies where that, you know, it interests people on that level, because I think we identify that when you're going through adolescence and stuff like that, you're starting to learn what your power is, what your individual talents lie. And wouldn't it be amazing if it was something amazing?
Right. Oh, and I think you have that period like where you look at your family and think, this can't possibly be my real family. Like, <You're right>. I have to be the son of Zeus or something. Like, I was rocketed to this planet from another world. Right. There's no way these are my actual people.
Or I have a ton of money, and they were all my parents and family were killed, and now I can do whatever I want with it.
Right.
And I can make awesome toys.
Yes. Classic story.
Right. Well, and what Claire did is, instead of having a young person discover the power and save the world, this is about a married couple that already had their power, already mm-hmm. discovered it, and already saved the world,
okay.
essentially.
Interesting.
And what happens after that? Most movies in there.
Right.
And most books in there. This one's like, because everyone just assumes, oh, yeah, the bad guys all just go away. No, we've learned from, the real world events. Just because you won the war, the battle's only just begun.
Right.
Because now they become the resistance. They become the sleeper cells. They become these things that are out there trying to rock things up.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So what she did is she had this husband and wife team that basically were the fulcrum point that led to the success of this kingdom being formed. And they decide to go retire, essentially get away from it all, because they're tired from having done all that work. And in the course of traveling back to this main city to kind of like an annual celebration thing that they do, they get waylaid, and the husband gets kidnapped by this group that's trying to break him mentally through torture
okay.
to turn him into a weapon.
Okay.
And they do this with several powerful magic users in the area. Through using mind control and psychological torture, basically turning them into, weapons. And it's the wife that goes on a journey to save him.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like the princess saving trope, but now it's the wife saving the husband.
I like it.
It's a set world that where it's, the burgeoning peace that is coming upon the world isn't always welcomed by everybody.
Right.
And what is going to happen in that regard? And Claire probably put it best is that this woman isn't saving the world, but she's saving what is in the world that she wants to save.
Yeah.
And it's really, really good. The first book came out, I believe, in November. She okay. self-published it in November. I picked it up in March. And her second novel just came out this weekend. When this was the launch weekend for that, so it's the Echoes of Amara series. First book's called To Whatever End.
Okay.
And the second book is called An Altered Fate, and it's available everywhere.
Awesome.
So that's one of them. The other series that we have that I'm really excited about is called Rotting Frontier.
Okay.
It's a zombie novel that's set in. That's set in post-Civil War frontier America. And as the story goes, it's a family that's leaving the Reconstruction period of the Civil War in the East Coast to try to go to Montana for the gold rush.
Okay.
It's like a typical idealistic father that thinks, if we go west, we're going to find gold and be
rich. Everything will be awesome.
Everything will be awesome. And about three-quarters of the way there, they get waylaid in Wyoming territory by a mixture group of Native Americans and ex-Union soldiers that are now zombies.
Uh-huh.
And they have what's called the hunger. Now, this is far and away one of the most interesting zombie mechanics I've ever read, and this is why I bought it. When you get bitten, you don't turn into this mindless automaton that goes around and just chews on people. You remain completely conscious of yourself and normal in all respects, but you have to feed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do not eat human flesh, you slowly descend into that creature, into that typical zombie that we know about until
right.
you can't control yourself and you do run after people and chew them up.
Right.
And so what he did here is he did a really cool morality play where, in this time in America, everybody was religious. Everybody believed in God. Everybody, or at least pretended to anyway.
Right.
And you have this unique place where some of the people that get bit they feel normal. They everything seems fine, but then they realize that, you know, people seem like they might be tasty. And then as it goes on and on and on, the urge to feed becomes almost overwhelming. And if they let themselves descend too far, they become a rotter, which is a true zombie that we know and love.
Right.
So they devolve into this creature.
That's interesting. And so people are sort of faced with this dilemma of, ironically, they have to make this moral decision. Am I going to sort of continue this? I mean, the only way out, I would assume, is death.
Yep.
So, yeah. So am I willing? What am I willing to do to stay alive and to be who I am? And what about my morals and my values? But I really, really want to eat that dude.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of this whole series is the antagonist in it is essentially modeled after George Custer.
Okay.
So, like, the idea here is if George Custer had this decision, what would he do with it? And it was pretty clear. What he would do is he would use it to eradicate the Indians.
Right.
The Native Americans. And in some small way, recruit them as like, okay, now you're part of my crew. We're going to take over the plains.
Wow.
So it's a cool alternative history.
Yeah.
And a cool mechanic. And, you know, you get these people that are really good people that end up getting bit. And they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do with themselves because in every other aspect, they feel normal. So the first book of the series, The Hunger, is centered on that beginning of that story. The second novel called Revelations is coming out next week. And that one continues the story in the plains. The third novel, which will be coming out this fall, and I love to tease this, is he has one of the individuals saying, okay, it's getting too crowded in the plains. I don't want my own food source. I want my own thing. And he emigrates to England.
Okay.
And becomes Jack the Ripper.
Aha, nice. That's a cool turn.
So the whole idea is that, you know, the Jack the Ripper thing was actually because a zombie was feeding on people.
I like that.
Yeah. And how he's able to hide himself is because he becomes a mortician in this really, really horrible area of London.
Right.
And that's how he's able to hide his thing. And his whole goal is he doesn't bite and leave and let people grow. No, he bites to kill.
Right.
And that's it. And that's how he protects his food source.
Right.
You know, so
it stays hidden in a way, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really a unique fantasy novel because it's set. And there's some, you know, things that some touchstones to real history where you go, oh, well, that could kind of explain why that happened or whatever throughout the whole series. And Dave Atwell, who is the author of that series, is a perfect example of why I do what I do. When I found his book, it was not done well. Like, the cover wasn't done well. The interior wasn't laid out properly. Like, just looking at the interior.
Wasn't packaged, right?
Right. But I read the back of the book, and I read his description of the zombie mechanic and called The Hunger, and I went, oh, wow. So then I actually sat down and read it, though the typeset and the interior made my eyes bleed.
Yeah.
I read through it, and I said, this guy is a person that needs a good cover, a good design, and it will sell.
Right.
And it has. I guess not to be too braggadocio about it, but, you know, we sold more in the first 3 days than he sold in 5 months in print.
Right.
And it's all, you know, I'd like to say it's all because of us, but like you said earlier, the interior of the book sells it.
Right.
They look at the cover and everything, that picks them up, they thumb through it, it looks like it's a book that they can read. And people will read it. That gets it in their hands, but it's the book that sells it ultimately.
Oh, yeah. No, a good... I mean, yeah, we all know you can have a... You can have a great-looking book that is not good.
Right.
But it's tougher to find... often when a book doesn't look good, it's not good.
Right.
And this is a case where it was the opposite. but it's enough to take you out. You got a bad cover. You open it's like I don't even want to. It's like I don't read it. I don't even want to look at the font that's on here.
Right.
I'm not going to read this book.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, and people do this unconsciously, is that when they see something like that, it equates to the quality of the writing. Like, if they can't get the interior right, how am I going to trust them with the book and my time and my money?
Right.
And that's, it just goes along, it seems like a natural thing, but most new writers don't really realize that. They think, if they read it, they'll realize it's good. Well, no, there's something about readability that makes it so where you want to stay up late at night when your eyes are tired and everything like that.
Right.
You know, so that you have a good font so that it doesn't make that worse.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah, you can have a great concept for a TV show,
right.
But if it's not filmed well, or you know the sound is off, it's like it just becomes grating.
Or the acting's bad. Even,
you have a great story, but bad acting. Yeah, that's the first thing you see.
Right.
And so yeah, it's tough.
Most authors come from the perspective that if we just put it out there, somebody will love it, and then somebody else will pick it up, and they'll take care of all that stuff, and they realize they need to do this first. Because ultimately, my goal is to keep them and publish them and sell them, but I would love it if, you know, one of the big five comes up knocking and asks about the rights for their book.
Yeah,
because that to me says that we did our job to get them out there.
Oh, yeah, totally. You can do things for them to move them up a step, but maybe can't necessarily at this point take them to the bit, you know, to the big giant stage.
Right.
And so if somebody else can do that, hey, great for them. And that's also a little kudos for us. But yeah,
it's kind of like, I kind of consider myself like minor league baseball. You know,
right.
if you go to the show, you know, that's awesome for you. Yeah, we lose our best batter, but, you know, we lose our show. So the other author I want to talk about is actually somebody, he's based in London.
Okay.
And it's Graham Austin King.
Okay.
And in Europe and in London area, in England in particular, you know, he's gotten kind of a following and everything. He really hasn't had much penetration here in America. And so I'm really excited about him. His series is called The Riven Weird Saga.
Okay.
And it's a story about the alternative dimension of fairies.
All right.
Of the fae, and how they're not necessarily good people, you know. A lot of people like,
right,
and some people think
all happy,
they think
Tinkerbell
of, yeah, exactly. No, these are not that. And and they want to take over our world. They want our world. They desire our world. They desire it. And and they're willing to be really awful to get it. But his series, he's my latest signing, and his series, the first one called Fae, The Wild Hunt, did really well. When it first released, he got some good publicity out of it, and for a while was, you know, on some of the, you know, some of the bestseller lists for the areas that he was in, you know,
right,
fantasy areas he was in. And his second novel came out a few months ago, called The Realm of Twilight, and beautifully written books. It's a different classical style, and of course, because he's British, you know, when I read his books, I have to. It's almost like Sean Connery's in my head, or somebody like that. You know, like I have the, or Pierce Brosnan. He's like in my head, talking to me. You know, I'm really excited about that. I suppose I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my own.
I think you should.
Novel, The Realmwalker Chronicles. It's a 16-volume series.
Okay.
So, and when I say that, everyone goes, "Oh my goodness!"
Right.
But what we did is we were taking a kind of a playbook out of the graphic novel and comic book industry, and what we're doing is we're releasing smaller volumes. And then having a kind of like a omnibus edition that comes out when the fourth volume of each series comes out. So 16 volumes, four total books, and each of the volumes are being released 3 months apart.
Okay.
So like unlike a lot of fantasy series where you get a book and then you're waiting a year, 2 years, or in George R. R. Martin's case, 5 years for the next book, 6 years for the next book. you're never going to be waiting more than 3 months to find out what happens next.
Gotcha.
Our big thing was interior illustrations. Again, I mentioned Seth Roswell Penn did the interior illustrations for it, full page illustrations as well as illustrated chapter heads. But the series is based on the idea that a world of balance, four almost equal continents, four realms, if you will. Each one of them kind of identifies almost like as a different genre of fantasy.
Oh, interesting.
So one of them is called Natura. That's a high fantasy, your Game of Thrones world, your Lord of the Rings world, that kind of thing that we're all known and used to.
Right.
Where everything seems familiar, but there's magic and stuff like that involved. And then it starts getting a little bit different. We have Elementa, which is an elemental world. That's a world where dragons and huge benthic creatures exist and, you know, rock elementals and stuff like that. And then, of course, there's Mecco, which is a steampunk world where there's gadgets and technology.
Oh, very
and
cool.
And then the final realm is called Necro, which, of course, is the gothic realm.
Okay.
And, you know, you have your... You have your shape changers and your shadow beings and, you know, the group called the Reavers, which mastered the afterlife and stuff like that. So it's you know, the whole idea is that this world is in balance. And there's one individual called the Realm Walker that is the goddess's avatar on the planet,
okay.
if you will, that has all the powers of the world at their disposal. So in each of these realms... Each of the goddess of Erda split her 16 powers evenly amongst all the beings of the world. And these individual powers, like, for example, one of them is like fire.
Okay.
You know, the affinity with fire. Well, they became dragons.
Nice.
So his idea is that these powers infused into these beings, and slowly over time, you know, through like essentially evolution, they slowly developed into these... The different races
kind of became an embodiment of that particular power
exactly.
or ability. Yeah,
exactly. And so the one individual called the Realm Walker has all 16 of these powers available to them, and
okay.
they can use it in any way that they like.
Gotcha.
And they're driven by a thing called the Aspect, which is a kind of like a personality influence inside of them. It's almost like they're possessed a bit by the goddess. Into doing what's right and keeping the balance.
Yeah, cool.
And so this is, and the interesting thing is we were just talking about this trope, you know, it's young people finding their power and becoming the center of the universe.
Right.
You know, the funny thing is that I wrote it like that and people go, oh, I've read this story before. And then they get about 30 pages in and go, oh, okay, so it's not like that.
Right, you took a left turn.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so that just happened. And that becomes a thing throughout the series is that just when you think you know you've read this before,
right.
I'll do something where you'll go, okay, I didn't read this before, but that's still really cool.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, we're really excited. We're really excited about the series. The two volumes are out now. The third volume is going to be coming out in the middle of June. The fourth volume is going to be coming out. And we're hoping, we're pushing really hard because we're going to be at Comic-Con in San Diego.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
A couple of us may actually be there as well, so hopefully
yeah.
we'll see you.
So we're looking to have the fourth volume. We're looking to have the fourth volume and the first omnibus edition released at Comic-Con in July. So we're really excited about
that's
that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So that's essentially us.
That's awesome.
Oh, there's one other thing I'd like to mention.
Yeah.
Is Claire Frank's husband... His name is David Frank.
Okay.
Is a master Lego builder.
Okay.
And so he builds these huge constructions of scenes. Like he helped out. He was one of the major constructors. And a lot of people may have heard of this, of the Rivendell scene that was done Lego. That was at Emerald City Comic Con a couple of years ago that everyone loved.
Yeah, that blew people away.
Yeah, and he's been doing recreations of our stuff, and I actually have a couple of them here, little small scenes from our books that I wasn't predicting that we would have this. We didn't know.
Right.
And so when Claire came from Seattle, she goes, hey, look what I got. I was so blown away because now I have a Lego set that depicts part of my series on it, and it's just like... It's like one of those moments where you go, you know you're getting close to coming to someplace and doing things the right way when people are making Lego stuff out of your
thing. Yeah. When you're in Lego form, that's a big deal.
Right.
That's a big deal. Yeah, no, I think, you know, talking to some of the folks when they're in a superhero movie or something like that, when they see an action figure based on them, it's like, I made it.
Right. And it's really interesting to me that the whole Lego community, that these builders that build these huge, massive sculptures that do this work, it's such a, you know, just talking to her and her husband about it, it's a different world. It's like, it's interesting things about these little enclaves of fandom where you think, oh, there's a few people that do this, and then you get into it and you go, wow, there's a whole nother world here. Like, they have their own website where they trade bricks because, funny enough, Lego, the corporation itself, doesn't really support them.
Right.
You know, they don't.
Right.
So they have everything that they do, all their bricks they get and stuff like that, is all about trading and sharing between them. So it's a whole another realm of things there, and that's just it blows me away. I think about that all the time, but you know, just like how deep the rabbit hole goes in some of these areas of fandom.
Oh yeah, and you got to think with something like that. I mean, I just started thinking about to build those kind of things and to be flexible enough, you have to have all this kind of stuff. And I just think of storing comics and how, you know, I have my system of storing comics, and for them, storing all those physical Legos and how you have to have a system. And I'm just imagining all these plastic containers with different shapes and colors. And
he has an office, you know, like, and I'm sure, you know, I know where you're coming from because I used to be a Magic the Gathering card collector. And
right.
I had 800,000 cards at one point. And, you know, it just a massive organization that comes into play. And then when you get a huge collection, you go to a show and you buy like 4,000 or 5,000. And then there's the sorting.
Yes.
And the grading.
Yeah,
and
it's a job.
It's a job. And it really is. But I saw a picture of his office, and he has a whole wall. It's a 9-foot wall, floor to ceiling. And it's like a big, huge shelving unit with all these tubs in it. And on the front of it, each marked with the type of brick, the size, the color, and everything. And that was just one wall. And he has three of them.
Wow.
Filled, and has easily close to 1 million bricks.
Holy moly.
The funny thing is, I don't know how he does it, honestly, because they have three young kids in the house. Okay. And how it doesn't get mixed up. I bought my son and put together the Mos Eisley Star Wars Cantina set for Lego. It took me 5 hours to put that stupid thing together. And in 20 minutes, it was completely destroyed, and pieces were all over the floor.
Oh, yeah.
And the only parts he plays with now is Han and Han and Greedo, and always saying that Han shoots first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at least we got that right. But he said, and I asked him about that, and he said, well, they know not to touch Daddy's constructions until he says it's time to tear it down.
Right.
And then they're perfect for that.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, we were joking that if we wanted to find, if my daughter was missing a Lego, I would just walk around in bare feet,
right.
and I would find it soon enough. There's nothing quite like stepping on a Lego.
Oh yeah, and my sons are the worst because he always insists on, it's not just one brick, it's like a saber on the floor or something, and it's like it gets the whole foot from the toes to the heel. I don't know how he does it, how he keeps 1 million of them together with three young kids in the house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's definitely got to be. There's a line.
Right.
Daddy's? These are daddy's toys.
Yeah.
These are your toys.
Right.
And I'm the same way. I mean, these are daddy's comics.
Right.
Don't mess up daddy's comics. You can read these comics.
Have you ever had an instance where one of your kids got a hold of something that was very, very valuable, and you just kind of went, oh, no, you know, somehow got a hold of something. I always worry about that with some of my stuff because I don't know how I would react if something that was, you know, like one of my collectible items was broken or permanently damaged. I mean, I would like to think that I'd be like, it's okay, you know, it's not the end of the world, you're more important. But I really don't know how I'd react if they...
I haven't had it happen with comics or anything. It was, I did have a lens for a telescope that, you know, it was sitting there. And I mean, it was, you know, and she just started fiddling with it. And of course it came apart. And once those lenses are out, it's next to impossible to get them to put back in. Now that's something that I could buy another one, but it was a lens that cost a pretty penny. And so, but it wasn't anything that was, you know, if it was something that was autographed by somebody or an original sketch, you know, that then it's like, oh, that's something I can't get another one of those. There was only one. So luckily that hasn't, I haven't had that happen.
It would be an interesting teaching moment.
For both?
For both. Both the parent and the child.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that they would probably remember that moment a lot longer than we will.
Right.
But, you know, I have eight kids.
Oh, okay.
I have eight children. You know, two of them are adults now and are doing their own thing. But, you know, and they're all fanboys and they love their stuff and everything. And one of the best compliments I ever got was my son saying, well, I know how to take care of my stuff.
Right.
And I said, really? He goes, yeah, you know, don't let the kids touch it ever.
Yep, that's why you can't have nice things if you start doing that.
That's right.
All right. Well, James, thanks so much for talking to us today.
You bet. Thank you.
You bet. And best of luck. Glad you guys have had a good show. And best of luck on your line and in your continued books as they keep coming out.
Yeah. If anybody's interested in looking up and finding out more about us, you can go to realmwalkerpublishing.com. Actually, this weekend we're having a buy one, get one free deal.
Oh, nice.
On our books, just trying to get the word out there and everything like that and promote it. So check it out and you know, drop us a line if you have any questions.
Perfect. All right, guys. So yeah, so realmwalkerpublishing.com, check it out and find a great book to read this summer. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
You bet.